My guest Yossi Klein-Halevi is the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His latest book is a memoir called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. He's also chairman of Open House, an Israeli-Arab dialogue group. But many years before he began this kind of dialogue, he was a member of a Jewish extremist group. Halevi grew up in Brooklyn, New York, the son of a Holocaust survivor. He moved to Israel 20 years ago. I spoke with him yesterday. He was in a studio in Jerusalem. Right before we started this interview, you told me you were hearing a lot of ambulances going by. Is this typical, and what goes through your mind as you are sitting in the studio talking with me, listening to ambulances going by?
Well, I feel like I'm listening to your question with one ear and counting ambulances mentally with the other ear. And that's what we've become, a society here that counts ambulances. One ambulance, we wait for the second. If there's a second ambulance and then a third, we turn on the news. And especially these days in Jerusalem, I think we've now crossed that line from being a city that occasionally is inflicted with terrorism to being a city at war. And that's really what it feels like now.
How has life in your neighborhood changed?
I live in a border neighborhood, which is to say at the very edge of Jerusalem. In fact, my apartment is in the last row of houses before the West Bank begins. From my porch, I can in effect see three countries. There's Israel, there's the West Bank, and then there's Jordan. And I'd say that sense of intimacy has become increasingly threatening in the last year. What was once, for me at least, an exhilarating feeling of cultural, even interreligious intimacy, has now become a daily threat.
Do you know any victims of the recent terrorist attacks in Israel?
Well, my 12-year-old son went to baseball camp. We have that here too, with a boy who was murdered, apparently by Palestinian shepherds in the Judean desert, and this boy was mutilated so badly that they couldn't identify him except through his fingerprints. And I was trying to shield the paper that morning from my son, and he found the paper and he looks at the picture and he says, "Oh my God, it's Kobe." So, and I was shielding the paper from him not because I thought he knew Kobe. I didn't know he did. I just didn't want him to start the day with that news. And then when it turned out he actually knew the boy, it was just one of those devastating moments that we've had more and more of here. And my own children, I have three, have been in so many close calls in the last few months that my wife and I have simply stopped counting.
When you were a teenager in the 1970s growing up in Brooklyn, New York, you were drawn to the Jewish Defense League, which was then headed by Meir Kahane. This is a militant, ultra-Orthodox group that was extreme in its hatred of all Palestinians and violent as well. Your issue was freeing Soviet Jewry, and you say your activism was limited to vandalism. But you had friends who were indicted for bombings and shooting attacks on Soviet institutions in America. Does that help you comprehend the Palestinian terrorist attacks on Israel?
If you're asking me whether I understand the mentality of terrorism, yes, I do understand it. I grew up in the Jewish ghetto in Brooklyn, a child of Holocaust survivors. And my worldview was formed, or I should say deformed, by a sense of us versus them. There was us and there was the rest of the world, which was either actively or passively against the Jews. It took me many years to learn to overcome that simplistic way of looking at the world. Terrorism is an outgrowth of fear, of self-righteousness, of being able to only understand or appreciate your own pain and not the pain of others. To explain or understand Palestinian terrorism today, to my mind, is no different than if I were sitting here now and trying to justify the kinds of terrorism that my friends were involved in and that Meir Kahane preached. Meir Kahane and Yasser Arafat belong in the same boat.
You've said that your group believed in the 70s that Jewish victimization granted you moral immunity. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You can't be a terrorist without believing that you have the right, because of your pain, because of the trauma your people has gone through, to inflict unlimited pain on others in the name of your own people's cause. You're dealing here in the Middle East conflict with two traumatized peoples, two peoples who've been victims of history. And on the Israeli side, the great success of Zionism, I would say, of Jewish sovereignty, has been to largely free us, and here I certainly include myself in this, to largely free us of a victim-dominated identity. It was only once I moved to Israel in 1982, left Brooklyn, left the diaspora, that I began to see myself in a more nuanced way and to see the Jewish situation in Israel in a more nuanced way, because we weren't victims. Jewish sovereignty had empowered us. The tragedy on the Palestinian side is, for understandable reasons, they haven't yet experienced sovereignty, but they haven't been able to take the opportunities that have repeatedly come their way in the course of the last 50, 60 years, beginning with the Peel Commission in 1937 through the UN partition in 1947 to Camp David and Taba in our time. If you see yourself only as a victim, you don't feel the power to take responsibility for making compromises. If I'm the victim, then my responsibility is simply to sit back and wait for more concessions.
Your father was a Holocaust survivor, and you grew up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, which is a neighborhood that was mostly comprised of Orthodox Jews, many of whom were Holocaust survivors. Was it that sense of being descended from a Holocaust survivor that helped give you that sense of victim?
Oh, absolutely. That's where it came from. And I was so immersed in my victimization that I didn't realize that I was growing up in the freest country in history, in the most secure Jewish community in history. I lived with demons. I was, in some sense, trying to become a surrogate contemporary of my father's. I was living out his life rather than living out mine.
Last year, you had a book that was published called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. This book was the result of, I don't know, 2 or 3 years of you traveling through the Middle East, trying to understand Islam and Christianity, going to a lot of churches and mosques, participating in services there. What motivated that search?
By the time I began this journey in late 1998, by that time it was clear that the Oslo process had failed. And one of the reasons I felt that it had failed was because it was trying to create an artificial peace between secularized elites on the Jewish side and on the Palestinian side, ignoring the deep reservoir of religious sentiment among both peoples. I wanted to do something that, so far as I know, had hardly been tried. And that was to see whether we could pray and meditate together. That part of the journey, I believe, succeeded. By the end of this journey, I felt thoroughly at home in a church, in the presence of a cross, which is traumatic for probably most Jews, whether they admit it or not. And in some ways, even more important for me as an Israeli, I learned to feel at home in a mosque. To overcome that primal dread that Israelis feel toward the mosque was one of the main goals for me on this journey. A very simple goal, but very, very difficult. And for me, it happened in, of all places, a mosque in a Gaza refugee camp. In fact, the same refugee camp where I had once patrolled as a soldier 8 years earlier and had been hit in the head with a rock. In fact, almost adjacent to this mosque. And it so happened through a series of connections that the sheikh there was willing to welcome me in. And I learned Muslim prayer. I learned to get on my knees and to pray with my kippah clear as a religious Jew, but joining that Muslim prayer line, learning to truly love Islam, to experience the total immersion of the body, that choreographed prayer that's the genius of Islam, and to experience that in Gaza. So whether this book is a footnote or whether it's a promise for the future, I don't know. But I can certainly say that since the outbreak of the Second Intifada, that part of the journey feels very remote.
You've written that the journalist and the spiritual seeker within you are at war.
Right. The job of the journalist is to chronicle what is, what exists. And what exists at this point in the Middle East is despair. The job of the spiritual seeker is to try to imagine what could be and what he believes on some level actually is, which is human oneness, and to keep trying to strive to that place of oneness. And I have to tell you, in all honesty, I don't think I've done a very good job maintaining the balance. I think this Second Intifada has been so devastating, so demoralizing in terms of what it says about the ability of the Palestinian leadership to negotiate for the sake of peace. I would argue 70% of Israelis would have been prepared to accept almost any compromise. What exists in Israel today as the hard core, the hard line, is not more than 30%, the settlers and their supporters. But the tragedy of this intifada is that Arafat has pushed most of us back right into the arms of the hardliners, and Israel today is a society in despair.
My guest is Israeli journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. He's the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His latest book is a memoir called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yossi Klein Halevi, Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. Over 100 Israeli reservists have signed a petition saying that they refuse to serve in the West Bank or Gaza because Israel, the Israeli army, is systematically humiliating the Palestinian population there. What was your reaction to this petition? And I should mention here that you served in Gaza with the Israeli military during the first Intifada in the late 80s.
I did, and my experience in Gaza in the late 80s was of being part of an occupation that could only enforce its will through a constant series of petty humiliations. That is how an occupation works. And for many years, we Israelis were deluding ourselves by imagining that we could create what we called a benign occupation. Now, I imagine there are different kinds of occupation. We, on the whole, I don't believe that we were guilty of atrocities, but in some sense, we were guilty of something worse, which is this constant stream of humiliations and really falling into a pattern where humiliation becomes part of one's reality. And that, in some ways, is the most destructive pattern of all. So that I emerged from that first intifada and my experience as a soldier in Gaza, convinced that we have to do everything we can to end the occupation. And that's why I came out of there, along with the Israeli mainstream, voted for Yitzhak Rabin. The night he won the election, I wept with relief. I said, at least now, this nightmare may be coming to an end. But what we discovered in the course of Oslo, which we initiated, we empowered Arafat, we brought him back here, we put police uniforms on his terrorists and tried to turn them into allies against terrorism. What we discovered was that sometimes the cure is worse than the illness. And what the Oslo process has done is empower an entity that is, in its essence, committed to terrorism and worse than that, to the destruction long-term, to undermining the legitimacy of Israel. And at this point, what we need to do as painful as it is to say this, is simply wait Arafat out, protect ourselves as much as possible from the terrorist war that's been declared against us, and at the same time seek alternative partners on the Palestinian side, which Sharon may be doing or may not be doing now. No one knows exactly what these negotiations are really about that Sharon has initiated with Abu Ala, Abu Mazen, and several others. And to what we're seeing now with the reservists is it's so insignificant compared to the enormity of the ideological collapse of the Israeli left over the past year, that to my mind that's the real story, and to come out with that kind of a declaration strikes most of us. And here I'm not only referring to right-wing Israelis. I'm referring to Israelis like myself who are in the center, or even many Israelis on the left, who are appalled at what the reservists have done. We are a country at war in exactly the way that you over there have been at war since September 11th. And I imagine that American society would react to if you had a draft, would react to that kind of moral squeamishness with the same impatience and anger that most of us here have reacted to the reservists.
Well, one last question. Our interview started with you hearing a lot of sirens going by and wondering what was happening, ambulance sirens. So when the interview ends, what are you going to do?
First thing I'll do is make a call back to my wife and see if she's heard any news, if everyone is home. And I know that my son was wandering around downtown, so that's the first thing on my mind. And, you know, I wrote this book, I went on this journey, and now I'm living in a very different reality. And to tell you the truth, there are times when I have to actually sit down and reread parts of my book to remember how exhilarating it was to pray in a mosque, to meditate with nuns in a convent. And to connect with that sense of human oneness and human potential. And if there's any message that I feel that I can still try to hold on to, and admittedly it's very difficult for me, it's that we religious people have a responsibility to continue to make sure that religion isn't abused and that God's name isn't taken in vain for hatred, for violence. And if I'm speaking this way, then I think at this point, the onus is on the Palestinian side to start rethinking some very basic premises. And the first premise to rethink is the Palestinian tendency to dismiss any legitimacy for Israel's existence. And what we learned in the first Intifada, and I certainly include myself in this, was that we, the Israeli side, had committed injustice in this 100-year war. And we learned that the Palestinian side has a case. They have a legitimate case. In this second Intifada, the onus is on the Palestinians to learn the same lesson about us. We have a case. We are a legitimate presence in the Middle East. We're not colonialists. We're not invaders. We are native sons. We belong to the Middle East. And until the Arab world, not just the Palestinians, until the Arab world makes its peace with the legitimacy of our existence, then the tragedy in the Middle East is just going to continue.
Well, Yossi Klein Halevi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Yossi Klein Halevi is the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His recent memoir is called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land.